1 billion capacity to upscale our industrial base.
Ordinary people don't see an end in sight to the crippling cost of living crisis.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings will go down.
Analysts suggest peace in Ukraine is the answer, but EU authorities say Kiev will be supplied with deadly weapons for as long as it takes.
It is for Ukraine, that is the country that has been attacked, to decide in which conditions it is ready to find peace with Russia.
Employment ministers have been assessing pressures on EU businesses due to high inflation and interest rates. Firms are also struggling to find skilled workers.
26% of companies all over Europe consider that labour shortage are a major difficulty for them.
Because EU leaders have cut off cheap gas and oil flows from Russia, winter 2023 will tell us all we need to know about the bloc's resilience, or lack thereof. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Italy-France government relationship appears to be again in freefall after French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said on Thursday that the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni is incapable of solving Italy's migrant crisis on which she was elected. The derogatory remarks, also reiterated by French Transport Minister Clément Beaune on Friday, have caused uproar in the Italian government. Prime Minister Meloni is said to be on the verge of cancelling a planned trip to Paris to meet French President Emmanuel Macron, while Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has demanded Paris an apology for what he called gratuitous and vulgar insults towards a friendly and allied country.
This rift of immigration can be framed in a European context with Italy that has repeatedly demanded to improve the burden distribution across the EU. This umpteenth diplomatic spat between Rome and Paris takes place on the backdrop of a new humanitarian emergency in Sudan, which can greatly exacerbate the migrant crisis.
Rome and Paris have often been at loggerheads in recent years. The latest rift dates back to November last year, when a French NGO-run search and rescue vessel carrying more than 230 asylum seekers was refused a port of safety by Italy's government for around 3 weeks.
On that occasion, in response to the situation, the French government suspended plans to take in 3,500 refugees who had landed in Italy, contravening the European Union's migrant relocation mechanism.
We firmly believe that Brussels must develop a coherent approach to distributing the migrants across the EU. About 94,000 migrants landed in Italy in 2022. You know how many migrants were relocated to France? 38. And to Germany, 57.
Later on Friday, Paris sought to play down the fresh row with Rome, saying that Italy is an essential partner to France and their relationship is founded on mutual respect. Meanwhile, migrant arrivals in Italy have more than tripled from last year. The country's recent centres are overcrowded and some have passed the breaking point. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi on Thursday wrapped up his two-day visit to Syria, where he met with his counterpart Bashar al-Assad. The visit was the first by an Iranian president to Syria since the Arab country was gripped by war in 2011. Raisi has called his Syria visit a turning point in bilateral ties.
This trip will be a turning point in Iran-Syria relations and will have an effect on the region and the trade and economic relations of the two countries.
The Iranian and Syrian governments have also issued a joint statement that highlights several points. The two sides have expressed strong determination to cement bilateral relations in different areas, particularly trade and economy. On Wednesday, the first day of his trip, the Iranian president signed a long-term comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement with his Syrian counterpart at the presidential palace in Damascus. Raisi said the long-term agreement will open a new chapter in cordial relations. 14 more documents were signed as well, all aiming to enhance bilateral cooperation. Iran, meanwhile, renewed its readiness to help Syria in its reconstruction efforts following the years-long conflict triggered by foreign-backed militancy. The pledge was made by President Raisi as he made a speech at the Holy Shrine of Hazrat Zainab, the granddaughter of Prophet Muhammad. Raisi also lashed out at the U.S. and Israel for backing terror groups in Syria.
For 12 years, the oppressed people hatched conspiracies and committed sedition, gave easy money to Daesh and Takfiri terrorist groups, used media empires to conduct psychological warfare, inflicted damage, destroyed homes, killed children, and made women homeless. For 12 years, the U.S., Israel, and the Takfiri Daesh terrorist groups they backed committed crimes in Syria. But Syria is standing strong today.
Combating terrorism is another issue Iran and Syria put focus on in their joint statement. They've pledged to continue to work together to fight terrorism and extremism until all terror groups are completely wiped out. The statement also denounces the U.S. military presence in Syria as well as its looting of the country's natural resources. It demands the international community to bring an end to the U.S. measures. The Iranian-Syrian statement also denounces Western sanctions imposed on both nations. Meanwhile, it slammed the Israeli regime for its repeated acts of aggression against Syria, saying that Damascus has the right to respond to Tel Aviv's aggression. The statement said that the Israeli aggression is a destabilizing factor in West Asia. Iran has said President Raisi's visit to Syria is in line with efforts to reinforce the axis of resistance in West Asia, including in the occupied territories, Lebanon, and Syria itself. This should be seen against the backdrop of Israel's weakening position in the region, as the regime is gripped by turmoil inside and facing mountain resistance outside. Iran and Syria are both under Western economic sanctions. The restrictive measures, however, seem to be a blessing in disguise for both nations as they're resolute in overcoming economic hurdles by forming stronger bonds and relying on their own potentialities.
On Thursday, about 6,000 employees from the Italian phone carrier Wind Tre walked out of work in protest against the management's decision to spin off the firm's network assets into a separate company. Wind Tre is the third largest Italian mobile operator with about 20 million customers and the second largest fixed line operator with almost 3 million subscribers. The industrial action had been called by Italy's three largest trade unions, CGL, CISL and UIL, against the unbundling deal, which unions and workers say is the prelude to mass layoffs.
We have to stand united against this spin-off. Breaking up companies always leads to detrimental consequences for workers. The best case scenario is that we get further stripped of working rights. The worst is thousands of layoffs.
The spin-off of telecoms operator Wind Tre will pave the way for the sale of a majority stake in the grid company to Swedish private equity firm EQT. Unionists say Wind Tre will shift some 2,000 workers out of a total 6,500 workers in Italy into the network venture.
Sta cambiando il modello industriale.
The industrial system as a whole is shifting towards a new paradigm in the communication sector, which features separating the management of the network grid from that of services. This way, Italy will further lose control on its strategic assets, and many smaller companies will kick in, exacerbating job insecurity in the country.
Job insecurity is rampant in Italy. According to statistical agency Eurostat's figures, Italy has the second lowest employment rate for young workers in Europe at about 30%. Also, Italy has no minimum wage, but protects workers through collective agreements, which often remains a dead letter for people on precarious contracts. Meanwhile, Italy's government has scrapped an anti-poverty benefit that goes under the name of citizen income, replacing it with a more limited inclusion check for qualifying households starting from January 2024. Prime Minister Meloni argues that the citizen income, which helped about 4 million people last year, costs too much and discourages people, especially youths, from looking for jobs.
Personally, I have been forever looking for a dignifying job, but the only things I'm offered are badly paid long-hour jobs. The citizen income should have been amended, but not scrapped altogether.
Nearly half of workers aged between 30 and 34 in Italy have an income between 8,000 and 16,000 euro a year, an income bracket that ranges from absolute poverty to near subsistence. An increasing number of Italians are leaving the country in search of better opportunities abroad. Max Civili, Rome.
Not only in the stories, some are among us and remind us of the fact that chivalry is not dead yet. Hamid Reza Aldari is one of them. The Iranian nation is mourning his death after he was brutally stabbed in the back and chest while defending two girls against a number of knife-wielding thugs in one of the streets of the northeastern city of Sabzavar. He later succumbed to his wounds in the hospital. Thousands of people from different walks of life took part in his funeral, hailing him as the martyr of courage and a brave national hero. His wife says he acted based on his zeal for defending the oppressed.
This could have happened anywhere else. My husband defended an oppressed person and fought until the last breath. This is the ultimate bravery.
To get a better understanding of the social aspect of this incident, I talked to a sociologist who noted that Martyr Aldari's brave act should be venerated by the people.
Here you see a citizen who acts based on his social responsibility as he observes a crime being committed. He has social commitment. This is very valuable, especially at a time when the global trend is individualism and people are after their own interests. Now a member of the society has stood up to defend another person and identifies with her. We must recognize this brave act and introduce this person as a role model to the society.
While a CCTV video showing the moment of Aldari's stabbing has gone viral, some anti-Iran media have tried to use it to attack the Islamic Republic's values. To get a better understanding of this, I asked Mr. Asghari about their intention.
Another aspect of this incident is that in social media you observe a rather different approach toward this brave act. Some media outlets follow frameworks that do not support Iran's national interests. The martyrdom of Hamid Reza Aldaghi has once again unified Iranian society. However, we see anti-Iran media try to use every incident to polarize the society, cause enmity among people, and increase anger in the society.
Acts of sheer courage by the Iranian nation that are based on moral and social responsibility have foiled anti-Iran media campaigns. Hamid Reza Aldaghi's martyrdom is a case in point that proves Iranians are always ready to give their lives to safeguard their values. Mahdia Bosian, Tehran.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi arrived in Damascus on Wednesday leading a high-ranking delegation. The president then headed to the presidential palace where he was received by his Syrian counterpart Bashar al-Assad with an official welcoming ceremony. The two officials held talks in which Assad underlined the importance and depth of relations with the Islamic Republic. He noted that both countries share visions based on respecting mutual interests and the two countries' sovereignty. Assad thanked Iran for its mediation efforts in Syria-Turkey peace talks and expressed support for Iran's right to peaceful nuclear energy. Raisi, for his part, congratulated Assad on Syria's victory in the war on his country, hailing resistance as an effective tool for free people of the world. He stressed relations between Syria and Iran were never affected by regional or international developments, reiterating his country's support for the people and government of Syria.
We discuss different topics as well as means of boosting our bilateral relations. We are determined to develop and expand our ties with regional states without a presence of foreigners, as they only cause instability. We should get rid of U.S. forces in our region. Securing Syria's sovereignty necessitates the withdrawal of U.S. troops.
The two presidents signed a long-term strategic comprehensive cooperation agreement. Ministers of both countries also signed a number of memorandums of understanding in the fields of oil, agriculture, rail and aerial transportation, free trade zones, earthquake reliefs, communications and information technologies.
Agreements today, as well as projects discussed, will push forward our relations through mechanisms that will increase the bulk of trade exchange and investments. This would reduce the impact of economic sanctions, especially at a time when world economic balance is shifting eastwards, and this would liberate world economies from Western hegemonies.
Assad also welcomed the restoration of diplomatic ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Officials are also set to discuss the establishment of a joint bank and insurance entity that would facilitate trade. The visit further consolidates the already historic and strong ties between Iran and Syria. It clearly launches a new phase of economic partnership following a successful military and political collaboration that set an example in the region in fighting terror and foiling U.S. and Western plots. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
It was his sixth hunger strike and the longest, which lasted for 87 consecutive days. Palestinian prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan stubbornly resisted until his last breath, asking for his release he always obtained after every hunger strike against his illegal administrative detention by the Israeli authorities. This time, however, his hunger strike ended with his martyrdom in a cold cell in the Israeli prison of Ramli at dawn on Tuesday. Here in his hometown, Arabi, near the occupied Jenin, his wife spoke to the crowd who gathered outside their home to consolidate the family and his nine children. They called for his revenge and also for all Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails.
I congratulate myself and my children for the martyrdom of Sheikh Khadr. Now, after his death and all the sacrifices he made, we do not want a drop of his blood to be spilled. We will not wait for anyone to avenge my husband. His nine children will keep his cause alive. And to the Israeli occupation, I say, remember the faces of my children well. By God, we have raised them with pride and dignity.
A general strike has been announced across the occupied West Bank in mourning for Sheikh Khadr Adnan. Protests have been held in several areas, including Ramallah. Palestinian resistance groups have mourned what they described as the execution of the senior leader of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, Khadr Adnan. They say they hold the Israeli occupying regime fully responsible for Adnan's murder. Since 2004, Adnan had gone on six hunger strikes, drawing local and international attention. Not only did he become a spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad, but also a symbol for the cause of Palestinian prisoners.
The Israeli regime has sent a clear message to the whole world that we will continue killing Palestinians even after their imprisonment. Today, Sheikh Khadr Adnan has set a new level full of pride in the history of Palestinian prisoner movement. After his assassination, the Palestinian people are facing a new stage of struggle. Today, we all must unite and stand against the practices of the Israeli regime for the sake of our prisoners.
All Palestine is sad for the martyrdom of the hero prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan. It was not his first hunger strike. Every time he was courageously declaring a hunger strike to reject the illegal administrative detention that the occupation's regime uses to keep thousands of our people behind bars. Unfortunately, this time his strike came to an end with his martyrdom.
Meanwhile, several protests have been held in the occupied Ramallah in response to the Israeli murder of Sheikh Khadr Adnan. The demonstrations turned violent in a number of areas, namely the cities of Arram, Al-Khalil, and Ramallah, with clashes erupting between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian protesters. Israeli forces fired at the crowds, and a number of Palestinians were wounded. The Day of Rage will always be remembered as a day of honor and loyalty to Sheikh Khadr Adnan, who is considered by many here as a national hero.
Every time Sheikh Khadr Adnan engaged in a hunger strike, he insisted that he will not end his action without achieving victory. His definition of victory was either getting released or being martyred. This time, he achieved victory by martyrdom. Palestinians also believe he was an iconic figure who succeeded in bringing another defeat to the Israeli regime. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Widespread loneliness in the U.S. poses health risks as deadly as smoking up to 15 cigarettes daily, costing the health industry billions of dollars annually, the U.S. Surgeon General said recently in declaring the latest public health epidemic. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Los Angeles Times, isolation and loneliness are an epidemic as damaging to Americans' individual and public health as smoking and obesity, the Surgeon General of the United States said in a stark advisory issued recently. Nearly half of the U.S. adults reported experiencing loneliness in recent years, according to research cited in the advisory. A 2021 study commissioned by the Cigna Healthcare Company showed 79% of people ages 18 to 24 reported feeling lonely, a rate nearly twice as high as that of seniors ages 66 and older. Though the issue was exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic, it has long been mounting. The rate of loneliness among young adults increased every year from 1976 to 2019. Surgeon General Vivek H. Murthy pointed out, being socially disconnected can have both mental and physical consequences. It puts people at greater risk for anxiety and depression and also increases the possibility of dementia by 50%, stroke by 32%, and heart disease by 29%. The risk of premature death from heightened isolation is comparable to smoking 15 cigarettes a day and maybe even greater than that associated with obesity and physical inactivity, according to the report. Still, studies show that 20% of people who feel lonely or isolated do not recognize it as a major problem. According to the advisory, Murthy laid out a national strategy to combat what he called profound threats to our health and well-being, saying the U.S. needs to address the epidemic with the same energy and intention it does the opioid addiction crisis or tobacco use. If we fail to do so, we will pay an ever-increasing price in the form of our individual and collective health and well-being, Morty said, adding, "And we will continue to splinter and divide until we can no longer stand as a community or a country." The report describes social isolation as objectively having few social connections or interactions, while loneliness is a subjective and internal feeling resulting from a gap between the actual connections people experience versus the desired connections they yearn for. Research shows people are spending less time with friends and family or participating in organizations driven in part by technology winding its way into our social interactions. Some people move away from their communities, many others focus on their careers at the expense of their personal relationships. A study cited in the advisory showed that between 2003 and 2020, time spent with friends decreased by 20 hours per month, while time spent alone increased by about 24 hours per month. And that rise in isolation may be eroding Americans' trust for one another. Polls conducted in 1972 showed 45% of Americans felt they could reliably trust other Americans. That number shrank to roughly 30% in 2016, the advisory noted. It's a trend that goes against human nature and is producing adverse effects on individual and societal health, said Julian Holt Lonstad, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Birmingham University and the advisory's lead science editor. Holt Lonstad said humans are a social species. Throughout human history, we've needed to rely on others for survival. So it makes sense that our bodies are adapted to promote survival. Because of the way humans evolved and adapted, feeling disconnected, particularly from those we trust, becomes a very threatening state, Holt Lonstad said, adding, it takes more energy and our bodies respond accordingly. Isolation causes our brains to become more active and signal various physiological responses that essentially throw our bodies out of rhythm, scientists said. One example is inflammation. Evidence shows that being isolated and lonely is associated with chronic inflammation, which increases risk of cardiovascular diseases, cancer, diabetes, depression, and Alzheimer's disease. Holt Lonstad said there are many cascading biological responses that are occurring, that when these physiological changes are dysregulated on a chronic basis, this can increase risk for developing a variety of chronic illnesses. It can also affect community outcomes ranging from population health to community safety, civic engagement, and prosperity. This is both an individual as well as a societal level health concern. The pandemic compounded the decline of social connections as well as isolation and loneliness by cutting people off from their support networks. But it also gave people a sense of how essential connection is, Holt Lonstad said, as they saw how less time with friends or family harmed their well-being and that of those around them. The Surgeon General Advisory, 82 pages long, issues a public call to action to foster greater social connection and provides a national plan to achieve it. Its six pillars include strengthening social infrastructure in local communities and mobilizing the health sector, offering recommendations that government agencies, workplaces, and others can take to bring people together in meaningful ways. In an essay published in New York Times days before the recent report, Morty described his own struggles with loneliness and underscored the risks facing America. Morty wrote, addressing the crisis of loneliness and isolation is one of our generation's greatest challenges. By building more connected lives and more connected communities, we can strengthen the foundation of our individual and collective well-being, and we can be better poised to respond to the threats we are facing as a nation. Meanwhile, RT noted, loneliness can lead to chronic stress conditions, experts say, which can be a cause of additional maladies. A study appearing in the National Library of Medicine even suggested that the risk of premature death linked to social isolation is similar to smoking 15 cigarettes per day. The advisory cites polling information from 1970s, which said that 45% of Americans felt they could trust people in their circles. That figure plummeted to around 30% in similar polling conducted in 2016. It also stated that the amount of time Americans spent alone rose by an average of 24 hours per month between 2003 and 2020. The advent of social media and other online services such as food delivery networks has also reduced people's interactions and needs to leave their homes, the advisory says. These institutions and such situations were magnified even further by enforced isolation brought about by lockdowns during the COVID-19 pandemic, which Morty said via the Washington Post recently poured fuel on a fire that was already burning. He said, "I want the country to understand how profound a public health threat loneliness and isolation cause in the United States." The advisory document also calls for efforts to be made to mend the social fabric to U.S., which includes factors like teaching children how to pursue healthy relationships and for people to spend less time on social media.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. All human blood may be red from a physiological perspective, but in the United Kingdom, blue blood rules. The coronation of King Charles III is living proof of that, as it took place on Saturday with much pomp and circumstances and a £250 million price tag for the British public. In a country where the quality of life continues to deteriorate for the average Brit, it becomes more obvious that the pomp is for a privileged few and pressure for the majority. Well, I'd like to talk about all of this on this Spotlight. Welcome my guests to the program. Lembit Opik, former member of British Parliament, out of London. And Nick Napier, activist and commentator out of Edinburgh. Thank you both for being with us. Well, actually, you're in Seattle, I guess. So, okay, I saw something else up there. You're in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Anyway, what does it mean, Limbit, to have a hereditary monarchy in the 21st century?
First of all, apologies for very poor sound. I couldn't make my normal hands-free work. In terms of your question, it means that a majority of people in the United Kingdom still do seem to support the monarchy, but the monarchy has to justify itself economically now. As you said in your introduction, Britain is a poor country. Relatively speaking now, it has huge economic problems. And the hundreds of millions that this coronation has cost really needs to be repaid, at least in terms of tourism by the royal family. But more than that, my biggest concern is that the government doesn't understand the contradiction. I don't really blame King Charles for the stupid economic decisions made by prime ministers. King Charles wasn't elected. He's a hereditary head of state. But the politicians should at least have explained why it's okay to spend this enormous amount on the monarchy rather than simply trying to suppress opposition. I think it's legitimate, regardless of my own views, legitimate to be a Republican, but you shouldn't have to justify yourself or get arrested for having taken that position. So fundamentally, it's the politicians rather than the royalty that I blame for the pressures that you rightly outlined in your introduction.
Okay. Well, Mick, your perspective and your belief system in dealing with this hereditary monarchy in the 21st century, when it's a country that always lectures others about equality, human rights. I mean, your overall assessment, Mick.
Well, I agree with the great British political revolutionary of a couple of hundred years ago, who was very influential in America and France, Tom Paine, who said it was as ludicrous to have a hereditary head of state as to have a hereditary carpenter or plumber, or he would say today, IT technician. It makes no sense, but it makes sense in one way. If we look at the three elements of the British state, the House of Commons is elected, the second chamber is unelected, and the monarchy, of course, by definition, is unelected. So there are large parts of the state which are not open to the will of the people. And although the demonstrations in London today and elsewhere, I haven't kept up with them, were quite modest, it's difficult to tell what percentage of the population sympathises with them. I mean, when I was younger, it used to be in every cinema, in a time when cinemas were the main method of public entertainment, that people were expected to stand at the end of the evening's performance for the national anthem. Well, because nobody stood but rushed for the exits, that particular institution was retired, because there was no support for it. It's difficult to know what the support for the monarchy is in any real sense. You can measure numbers, and older people tend to be much more conservative and much more pro-monarchy. Among young people, it's a very different story. Mm-hmm. And the last numbers I read were that 40% of people under the age of 25, preferred a monarchy, and something very similar preferred a republic, and something very similar for those under 35. So it's difficult to measure. It's also difficult to measure because although a fellow guest says it's not illegal to be a Republican, it's certainly disparaged in the mainstream media. We learned a few days ago that the BBC, in its meticulous and expensive publicly financed preparation to cover the coronation, actually puts its footage to the palace, first of all, for its agreement. So in a very real sense, the chunk of the population who are Republican in sympathy, or the equally large proportion who don't care, and don't support the monarchy, okay, their views are filtered out.
Well, Limbitt, pro-royalists, when answering critics, say that the Queen, or now the King, is mostly a ceremonial role. How can that be said when technically he can appoint and dismiss ministers and even declare war?
Good question. And it's down to the behaviour of the royal family. Now, I won't give you a history lesson in British monarchy, but hundreds of years ago, one member of the royal family, one king, ended up in huge trouble for trying to push Parliament around. Different politicians and different monarchs get on to different degrees. And the big question isn't so much the constitutional position, because as you've just heard, it is theoretically a ceremonial position. It's the extent to which the monarchy seeks to influence Parliament. But here it gets complicated. With a good political system, with a good Prime Minister, with a good Parliament, everything's beautiful. It works well. The monarchy perhaps is a nice adornment, a nice, beautiful thing to look at, something that brings tourists to the UK. But if the government is weak, the monarchy becomes more powerful. And that's what ironically provokes republicanism and makes it harder for the monarchy to justify itself. But that's because the elected politicians aren't doing their job. I actually think that's the situation we're in now.
Well, Mick, with rising food prices, rents, and much pressure on the National Health Service, NHS, do you think the average British citizen benefits from the presence of the monarchy in general?
It's very patchy. I just saw the much-hyped call to come together in the main square of Glasgow, my native city, to celebrate the monarchy and even to take a vow of allegiance. And the square was empty. There was a huge big screen available for anyone who wanted to participate, but people had voted with their feet or actually by not using their feet. So given that today we have millions of people relying on food banks, that most people have a very genuine sense that the much-loved National Health Service, one of the gems of British culture, is in danger and is being whittled away government after government. The fact that when, you know, people who are now in in the internet economy actually delivering goods around the country earn such low wages that they have to drive dangerously in order to make a living. And, you know, my daughter lives in Berlin and lives quite well in terms of being young, but being able to rent a house where the rent controls are very, very significant. Young people in Britain are finding it impossible to live, certainly to buy a property, but to pay rent, which doesn't reduce them to dire straits. So life is hard. And in that situation, the monarchy is an institution of the state, and the views of millions and millions of people intersect in the person of that monarch. Some support it, some despise it. But at the moment, there's a widespread sense among the experts, and in fact, John Curtis from Strathclyde University is widely seen as the leading pollster in the country. He's saying that there's still a majority for the monarchy, but really it needs support because the support is ebbing away, especially among young people.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, Limbit, in a country where basic staples have skyrocketed and 1 in 10 kids are facing poverty and even working people, such as teachers, where 1 in 5 are experiencing food poverty, in general, why would so much money be spent for the royal family? And a lot of it, especially if what we saw today, again, being funded by the working class. It just seems, where's the equity in all of this?
Well, there is no equity in it. The difference between the richest 5% and the poorest 5% in the United Kingdom is horrendous. In many ways, we're like a third world economy where if you've got it, you can get richer. If you haven't got it, you can't even afford to pay your rent, as my colleague has just said. But there's a different question to ask here. Does the royal family do more good than harm? Now, I have to say that in terms of the opinion polls, my personal view is that most people in politics in Britain do still feel that the monarchy is relevant and they want it. One of the ironies is that oftentimes the Queen was preferred as the person to run the country more than the Prime Minister. And then I move to my second and perhaps the central point here. The lack of equity isn't because the royal family have made stupid mistakes in government policy. It's because the government has made stupid mistakes in government policy. If the UK really was a superbly wealthy country, then actually the royal family, even if it was making a slight loss, is an affordable luxury. I suspect the royal family does make quite a lot of money in terms of economic turnover. But fundamentally, the problem is the argument has not been made satisfactory by politicians. And what I think we now see is a potentially popular King Charles III and a potentially extremely unpopular political situation where the Labour Party and the Conservatives, the two main parties, simply aren't talking to the country. And here's the biggest irony. Imagine if I'm right. Imagine if King Charles III becomes a more attractive leader of this country than the people that we elect. So, yes, it's expensive, but it's far more expensive to the UK if the public preferred the unelected royalty than the elected government.
Well, it's interesting what you said, Limpet, because it already appears that Charles doesn't have a whole lot of charisma. I mean, because when talking or looking at people's statements, our correspondents on the ground there, there were positives said. More positive said about the Queen, of course, in her 70-year reign, and there was a bit of a reassurance perhaps given by her. And she stayed, for the most part, tried to stay out of controversial domestic matters, whereas Charles, even as prince, was not so successful. So it doesn't seem that he's going to have a whole lot of charisma during his reign. I mean, your take. Go ahead.
I've been lucky to meet him a few times. Actually, at a personal level, I have to tell you, I've just got to tell you the truth. He is charismatic.
Okay.
He's likable. He's quite charming, and he's very funny. But he's also quite political. The Queen, especially on things like the environment, the Queen was careful not to be quoted in public. Sometimes she was, and that caused anger to the royal family and to the advisers. But she had 70 years to build her popularity. King Charles has only had one, and let's remember that the royal family under the Queen about 20, 30 years ago was really unpopular when Princess Diana died in that terrible car crash in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest problem for King Charles is he is not the master of his own destiny. How the public feel about the interrelationship between the head of state and the head of government, that's a really big factor. Can King Charles be as popular as the Queen? Maybe, but he won't have 70 years to do it. I watch with interest what he does. I want him to do well. The Queen did, I think, very well in her role. King Charles didn't choose to be born into the royal family, and he has got a duty of care for what his responsibilities are. Maybe others say that we will become a republic. I don't think that's going to happen soon. And therefore, if I was King Charles, the next time I met the Prime Minister, I would say, you've got to do a good job so that I don't get the rep for your bad behavior, because I can't come into the Commons, knock on the door and take over, even if I'd like to.
Right. Well, he didn't choose to be a king or part of the royal family, but, you know, £250 million worth, personal fortune of £1.8 billion. It's not a bad position to be in for him, I'm sure. Well, Mick, overall, I mean, we've talked about the stark contrast between the older and younger Brits and the existence of the monarchy in general. And today, with the coronation taking place, there were protests and chants of "Not my king." Do you see the role of the royal crown diminishing in the future, or your overall assessment?
Well, we have to define what the role of the monarchy is, and I think it's overwhelmingly symbolic. It's a symbol of grotesque privilege, lording it over, great poverty and great lack of security. I mean, there is a political element here of real power. There was I can't remember the year, but an Australian government was dismissed by the Queen's representative, the government, the Governor General, and she dismissed a left-wing government opened up the road for a right-wing government to replace it. And Australians remember this very, very well. So although the powers are residual, they remain real in periods of crisis. Lembit mentioned the situation when Princess Diana died. It wasn't a political crisis, but it was a profound crisis for the royal family. They trembled in their palace because a spasm of powerful emotion went round the country, which measured Princess Diana very favourably against the rest of them. And that crisis it's essentially a corporation, the royal family, but that crisis inside the people who managed that corporation was very profound and very real. And they managed to ride the wave of rage and anger, but it might have been quite a close-run thing. But the main thing about the monarch is it symbolises privilege, it symbolises inherited wealth, it symbolises the domination of people who may lack any quality, any redeeming quality, but who solely by virtue of the bed into which they are born becomes head of state or become a group of royals who have a huge, huge silver spoon in their mouth. So it's that grotesque endorsement of inequality which I think rankles with millions of British people today. Difficult to tell how it will take shape, how the Republican movement will develop, but I think John Curtis is right. Although there remains a majority for as measured by pollsters, the foundations look increasingly shaky, and unless there's action taken to strengthen them, then I think the future looks challenging for the House of Windsor.
Okay. Well, I'd love to continue this conversation, but unfortunately we got started a little late because of some technical issues. I appreciate both of you being with me. Lembit Opik, former member of the British Parliament out of London, and Mick Napier, activist and commentator of Edinburgh. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse